funny with attics, isn't it, in houses?
Yeah.
They often, if you're downstairs, the attic, very scary, yeah? But if you're in the attic, very safe, and the downstairs is scary. Interesting, that, isn't it?
I tell you what, this, the scariest thing, scariest moment of all cinema happens, for my money.
That's a rather bold claim.
It's a bold claim because it implies I've seen all cinema,
yep.
Which, caveat, I clearly haven't.
You have seen 3,000 films or something. You normally start sentences by saying that, but...
I think this the scariest moment in all of cinema happens in an attic.
Right.
It's you're never going to see it because you don't watch scary films.
I'm scared just listening to you.
It's called Rec.
Oh, I've seen Rec.
The Spanish?
Yeah, the Spanish zombie film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen Rec, yeah.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, it's not scary, it's a zombie film, it's not a horror film.
The bit when she goes up into the attic and it's all night vision.
Sure, yeah. Pretty spooky.
Phenomenal.
You think that's the scariest moment in cinema, do you really?
For me, that's the most scared I've ever been. And it speaks to the importance of when you watch a movie and the headspace you're in when you watch it.
Right.
If you're just half watching that on a laptop in the middle of the day, it's not probably going to touch the sides.
Yeah. Do you know what's scary for me in that way was, well, two things. The first one is contextual scary. The first time I ever watched The Seventh Seal, which is that Ingmar Bergman film.
Who's he?
He has these wonderful shots. It's all black and white. It's got these trees, evergreen trees, kind of blowing in at dusk in the sky. There's something very eerie about it. I'm not entirely sure what. It's not a scary film, really.
It's about death, though, isn't it?
It is about death, but there's just something very unsettling about those scenes. But then, of course, the film that scared me more than any other film, contextual as well because of my age, is a film I didn't even see, was The Ring, with the girl coming out of the well and coming out of the TV.
Yeah.
I've never watched The Ring. I will never watch The Ring, but it was very popular when I was a young teenager, and it was obviously also the
remake or the original?
Oh, I don't know. Was the one I'm talking about was the one that would have come out in the 2000s. Was that the remake?
I think that must be the American.
Yes, the American. Oh, is it based on a foreign film?
It's based on the Japanese original J-horror.
Didn't know that. J-horror.
It was a big time thing.
Well, it had made such a cultural impact at the time. It was kind of impossible to avoid those sorts of scenes and the story in other media. And it really scared me. In fact, I watched Scary Movie 3 the other day, and The Ring is one of the films that they are parodying in that film. And even in Scary Movie 3, it's quite scary as a concept.
You'll never be able to enjoy the true horror of Ring because you've seen it's been deflated by pop culture and parody. I think in the same way, I love The Shining. I would have seen The Simpsons parody of that before I saw The Shining.
Yeah. Whereas I don't think I had. I think I came to The Shining pretty fresh.
All right, you don't have to show off about it. All right, I'm just opening myself up.
Well, how about this? ScreenRant.com has ranked what they believe to be the 13 scariest movie scenes ever. And actually, in at number 10 is Jack Enters the Room. Would you like to hear some of the others?
Let's rattle through them.
Yeah, okay. In at 13, the red face demon appears in the film Insidious.
Never saw it.
Cool. The videotape in The Ring is number 12.
Yeah.
Oh, the final confrontation, the Blair Witch Project. The little clip, the scene they've got here is of the boy stood, turned to the corner.
In the corner. Yeah.
I like that film.
That's good. That is a textbook example of time, place. You've got to be in exactly the right... And I've seen it now. Am I going to get sucked into the same scary headspace? I don't think so. I'm older and jaded.
Not that scary anyway.
Yeah, you have to really go into... by a part of your, there's a cognitive dissonance to watching that film of knowing it's not real, but believing that it could possibly be. Yeah, they went out there and did it, which is was a huge part of the marketing and the mythology behind the movie.
Yeah.
Which was fun, which is really worked. You know, a lot of people at the time, even then, were saying, this isn't scary, it's just a bunch of fucking film students running around the woods.
Sure, sure, sure. No, well, no, well done to everyone involved. Absolutely.
It's a very good film.
In at number 9, Dallas is deaf in Alien.
No.
No.
I mean, it's shocking,
sure,
but not scary. And if you watch it now, it...
Not the, scary at all.
The special effects kind of...
They're the scariest thing about it. Rosemary meets her baby. I've never seen Rosemary's Baby, as discussed before.
That's not the scariest bit of that film.
Okay.
I think they're struggling to find...
There is
no scariest bit of the film. That's the
Maybe
film...
Maybe this is a cheat list. Yeah.
The film is scary.
Well, in at number 7 then, maybe this one fits too. It's Peter's Nightmare in Hereditary.
Yeah, that was quite unsettling.
Number 6, Reagan's head spins in The Exorcist. The head spin.
That's not the scariest thing. The film in
its entirety.
It's the most famous
bit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, is this called the most famous... Is this list the most famous bits in horror movies?
Well,
no.
You tell me after I tell you number 5. Marion Crane is killed in the shower in Psycho.
Fuck's sake. Psycho, that's not... Oh, maybe at the time... They all shit themselves. But when you're watching that in the modern day, you've all been... You've seen The Simpsons. The Simpsons fucking parody it.
That
moment has no shock value and is not scary in and of itself. The film, in its entirety, is unsettling and scary. Right, what's next?
In at number 4 is Sarah's reanimated corpse in Suspiria. Dario Argento's visually stunning, deeply unsettling horror classic Suspiria is full of scary scenes.
Is that... It's not, really.
Well,
it's
apparently
good.
The scariest moment in the film is when Sarah Sims' mutilated corpse is reanimated and creeps into the room, and that the scene ensures that the climactic sequence of Suspiria is the most horrifying part of the entire movie. That's what Screen Rant says.
Yeah, I think Screen Rant are a bit thick. The scarier bit is actually in the remake, and when Dakota Johnson is doing her dance, and then that's transmuting to the other dancer.
Yeah,
and she's
haven't seen it, mate.
Yeah, it's Luca Guadagnino.
Guadagnino.
It's your best buddy.
There you go. Well, I've seen this next film.
Hang on, let me just the sequence. That sequence is amazing and it's so scary. Yeah. And it's you see this other dancer's basically getting her body is snapping and limbs. She's getting smashed against walls, and it's like Dakota Johnson. Is she called Dakota Johnson?
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
Fuck me.
Also, I think this film was made by Dario Argento.
Yeah, no, and I'm saying the remake by Luca Guadagnino actually has a scarier bit. I watched the original after the remake, so I'm probably not.
Have you read the book yet? Guess film number 3. Guess the film number 3 from this quote. Weep, weep, weep.
Don't you...
Squeal, squeal, Peggy. Squeal.
Oh, Deliverance.
Yeah, the attack in the woods in Deliverance.
It's funny, like, you know, you just... What is scary and what is... versus what is upsetting or disturbing.
Yeah. Number 2.
Number 2.
John meets his foreshadowed fate in Don't Look Now. All throughout Don't Look Now, John Baxter has mysterious visions of a figure wearing his late daughter's red coat and a funeral procession on the canals of Venice.
Yeah, so the scariest bit is when the little dwarf turns around and chops him in the neck.
Right. I've never seen the film. Okay, and the final one, I haven't seen this either. It's Dinner with the Leatherface Family, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, that's pretty...
pretty scary?
That's tough, scary stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
That's both unpleasant to watch and genuinely scary.
Well, Who doesn't love human meat? Huh?
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. And joining me as ever, it's the old leaky bucket boy, Joe Devine. He's popped his old bucket into the oven and he's popped it on 280 degrees.
280?
Yeah, it's hot. It's hot in the oven and he's forgotten about it and it's melted.
Right.
It's Joe Devine.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good, man. How are you?
Yeah, fine. This is the podcast in which we talk about the movies we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. That's our wheelhouse. That's what we like to do. Mm-hmm. On today's episode, we are doing the 2001.
Oh.
2001. Cameron Crowe directed Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
Starring Timothy Cruz and Penelope Cruz.
Look at you doing and Cameron silly little names for people. Remember when you used to mock me for that?
Of course you love it. Of course it's a remake. It's a remake of Abre los ojos.
Yeah.
Open your eyes. Open your eyes, for God's sake. If you didn't know...
Just say Abre los ojos one more time.
Abre los ojos.
Oh, there it is.
If you didn't know that meant open your eyes, watch this film.
Yeah.
And you'll hear that line about 50 times.
Yeah, it's the first line of the film.
It's a horribly thick 136 mins. I don't like that.
It's far longer than it needs to be.
Let's go to the Letterboxd overview.
Can I guess the blurb this week?
Okay.
Tom Cruise wakes up alone, but is he alone? No, it's a dream. And then he is kind of creepy and fancies his friend's date and then has an accident and then, whoa.
I think you're showing your hand far too early as to whether you liked this film.
I can't keep my hand closed, I'm sorry. But it's a bit closed because my feelings are more complicated than I've just made them sound.
Forget everything you know and open your eyes. David Ames, played by Timothy Cruz, has it all. Wealth, good looks and gorgeous women on his arm. Wealth on his arm.
He has good looks on his arm. His face is horrendous, but his arm is one of the sexiest arms I've ever seen.
But just as he begins falling for the warm-hearted Sophia, Penelope Cruz, his face is horribly disfigured in a car accident. Yeah. That's just the beginning of his troubles.
Oh, fuck me, that's amazing.
That is bad. I'll tell you what, mate, I'll tell you what. I had a really bad day the other day. I woke up, I stubbed my toe, and I was late into work, and I went out for lunch, and then I was in a horrible car crash. My face was horribly disfigured. But I tell you what, that was just the beginning of my troubles.
How could it get worse than that?
I know. Imagine, I would have thought that would have been the end. Like, everything would have been plain sailing. Sorry. That's just the beginning of his troubles. As the lines between illusion and reality, between life and death, are blurred. And that's what your Letterboxd has to say.
Fairly accurate.
Cameron Crowe wrote and directed, I don't know if that's important, obviously based on the Spanish film. Penelope Cruz starred in the original.
Are you going to say Cruz all episode? Or
don't think that's...
Well, it is if you're Spanish and you have a Spanish accent. It's not if you're Catalan, for example, but like if you're Spanish, you might say Cruz. But it's not necessary for you to say it. Everyone else understands that when... You know, like so there were some people that used to say Santi Cazorla when they were talking about Santi Cazorla, the the Spanish football player. It's just not. It's not necessary. Right. It's not necessary.
Is it annoying you?
No, not at all. I was just curious about it.
I think you should. I think you should chill.
No,
out.
No, I'm calm. I'm completely calm. I was just curious about about your perspective on it. Whether you were saying it for fun, whether because Spanish is still one of those languages and those accents where.
Bonjour. Nice sweater.
I got you on this, much as I sort of didn't want to, because I was at pains every time.
Much to your chagrin.
Much to my chagrin. Love that word.
Yeah.
And I went back into my Letterboxd as I obviously I posted my recent review and thoughts, and I'd rewatched this having never seen it since the cinema. On its release. I saw this when it came out, 2001.
Oh!
I saw it at the Hemel Hempstead Odeon with a friend of mine who I'm no longer friends with. And I remember becoming increasingly aggravated and annoyed as to how the film was playing out. And come the end, I was positively... I wasn't even apoplectic. I just thought, "What are you joking?" He was dead. Not the entire time, but for quite a lot of it.
Half the time.
Half the time.
Yeah.
So when's that? So then, I saw it 20 years later. There was a 20-year gap.
Wow.
And I decided I'll watch this again. Do you want to hear what I wrote?
I'd love to hear what you wrote.
And then we'll do you.
Okay.
So. This is bizarre because I don't recognize this guy. This guy who wrote this review and gave the star rating, I don't know who it was, and this is 2 years ago.
Were you having one of those days where you felt at one with the world?
I gave Vanilla Sky on October the 1st, 2021, 4.5 stars.
4.5 stars.
I saw this at the cinema.
Coming from a guy who gives good films 3 stars and acknowledges they're good.
I saw this at the cinema all those years ago. I used that number of L's.
Did you really? You used the L, that number of L's instead of that number of A's?
Oh, no, you're right. Do you know what? I've missed... No. Al. Al.
I saw this at the cinema. Al. Those years ago.
Al. Those years ago. Felt the film losing its grip on me as the dream logic ended with that reveal. And now, watching it, knowing what it is, really, is very good. Twee Cameron Crowe-isms aside, it's dark and twisted and Black Mirror-y, well before Black Mirror, but not before the original was, I suppose, ofs. I don't know what that means. Oh, the original Abre los Ojos. Sure. It all makes sense now. It all clicks. I'm popping it in the hugely underrated bucket.
Wow.
Fuck. Now, listen. I don't want... That's not canon, that review.
Right. How come?
Well, this is the canon review that I've just logged.
And can give me the star rating.
3 stars.
that sounds more about right. Yeah.
I gave this 4.5? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Unravels after the car crash. Soundtrack is a needy mixtape stuffed into your ears by someone keen to showcase their taste. All Cameron Crowe flicks. Once you see the Scientology vibes, it's hard to take at face value. Mox medication, psychiatry. It's been a brilliant journey of self-awakening, which is a line in the... that's a line of dialogue. It's been a brilliant journey of self-awakening. Has it? Still has its moments. And that's it. I've got one like. So I've been on a... Hey, mate, I tell you what, in terms of journeys of self-discovery, I've been on a bloody brilliant one with this movie.
What an up and down you've had there. I'm so curious as to what was happening for you that day. You must have been a little emotional for some reason to connect with it in the way that you did. But that's terrific. That's, you know, great. It sounds like you watched it at the perfect time.
Well, I was in a place where I thought I'd grown up, and I was looking back on my younger self thinking... He was very judgmental about this movie. He took it at face value and was very it, you know, he didn't realise what he was watching, and he was angry because it became, because at its heart, a film that has baked into it that so much of it is not really happening is frustrating. So then if you're rewatching it as 20 years later, knowing that, feeling quite generous, thinking, you know, this looks, it looks pretty good. This is what he thinks, not me now. It looks, it looked good. It's quite dark for a Hollywood movie, and there's some interesting stuff going on. And so I've he's overcorrected for the other version of me. I would have had that on my letterboxed jacket.
Yeah, with all these new followers you've got, they would have looked at that and thought, oh, that's a rogue one from Adam.
What? When did you see this when it came out?
No. I saw this probably on video or DVD for the first time when I was a teenager. I've still got the DVD somewhere in my DVD case, big case thing.
Do you remember how you responded to it?
Oh, I loved it. First time round. As a teenager, I thought this is cracking stuff. Terrific, lovely soundtrack. A mixture of songs I already knew and loved, songs that I would grow to know and love, you know, and you know me, I'm a real tone guy. And so when any film starts with a Radiohead song, I'm just locked in. I'm just completely locked in. And I love the romance of it. When I was a teenager, I found the scenes between Penelope Cruz and Tom Cruise to be very intoxicating and compelling. And I loved the, you know, as a teenager, I believed, and to still do to a certain extent, that the world revolves around me. So the nature of controlling my own world and of all of the other people in it being figments of my imagination, there's something that tickled my ego about that. And I thought that the best friend character was really cool. And I thought it was like, I liked how they had the little callbacks to, you know, you created a character like Bill Pullman, kind of like a father, I can't say father in America. Kurt Russell, Bill Pullman. They're the same person. It doesn't matter to me. They're exactly the same person.
Don't say that to someone whose favourite film is The Thing, mate.
Sure.
They're not the same person. Bill Pullman is a nothing of a man.
Right.
Okay. Kurt Russell is in The Thing. Plissken.
Right. Do you think that Cameron Crowe met Kurt Russell at the Almost Famous premiere?
I don't know why. Why do you ask that?
Because isn't What's-Her-Face his daughter?
Oh, Kate Hudson.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Is that a funny joke?
Is it a joke?
I mean, do you not think Cameron Crowe would have been familiar with Kurt Russell's work before?
I'm sure he would have been familiar with Kurt Russell's work. I'm saying, do you think that's where they met?
I don't know if you're... I never know if you're doing a bit or not.
Or Almost... Why would I be doing a bit? Almost Famous came out a year before Vanilla Sky. Perhaps they met through that mutual connection and thought, oh, you'd be terrific for this role, Kurt. Would you like to come and do it with Timothy Cruise?
Joe, I love that. You're so... You've got such sparky ideas sometimes.
Was he in Jerry Maguire or something? I haven't seen Jerry Maguire.
He was not in Jerry Maguire. You haven't seen Jerry Maguire?
No, I don't give a fuck about Jerry Maguire. I don't care. You know?
That's one of those movies. You know how I love talking about my theory?
Yeah, which theory?
The theory, it's the Oscar theory about a film that gets taken on board by the Oscars. And then as a result, there's a backlash to that film.
There's a run on the bank, yeah.
Jerry Maguire's got my money. He's got your money. That doesn't make any. Anyway. It gets a stink on it. The stink on it. It's called the stink on it theory.
I didn't know that it had any kind of stink on it. Maguire? I didn't know that. So and all I know is that it's got Tom Cruise in it, and I get it confused with Cocktail, and I just am not interested really in Tom Cruise as an actor, so I don't care, and I've never watched it.
Yeah, so you're kind of outside of the conversation, so you can't really get in on the conversation about Tom Cruise.
It's not that, it's just that the conversation's happening outside my house and I've shut the door, it's not that I'm outside of the conversation, it's that the conversation's outside of me.
Either way, if you need to frame it that way for your ego, like, no, I'm in my house and you're all out there. It's like,
house has a really big garden and a gardener.
Just accept that you're a tiny little nothing who's staring in on culture. Just accept that.
I will accept that if you accept that you're ever so slightly more tiny than me.
Mate, I'm the fart that you're having, all right? I don't care. I'm happy. I am nothing. But,
sure.
But
why did you think I was doing a bit when I was talking about Kurt Russell?
You can't change the topic. We're now on
No,
you.
I'm being serious.
No. We're now...
Is he in another Cameron Crowe film that
I will
I'm unaware
not
of or
be
something?
Derailed on my point about you thinking you can have a conversation about Cruise when you haven't even engaged.
Oh, there was a beep in the background there. You might want to say that again or just start a different bit.
You can't engage with...
Which bit? Jerry Maguire?
Yeah. Okay.
Oh.
And I don't mind...
Well, I watched Top Gun.
I don't mind you... Look, it's fine. You want to write him off and I get
what,
all that.
Cruise?
Yeah.
I'm not writing him off. I watched him in Vanilla Sky. I thought that was fine. And I tried to watch the Mission Impossible films. I don't care. I watched Top Gun. I don't care. The next thing, the next, you know, window that Tom Cruise comes a knocking at is the Scientology window when I'm watching the Louis Theroux film and imbibing all of this American culture about how strange all that stuff is. It's very hard to take Tom Cruise seriously as an actor. I watch him as a movie star and I think, hey, this guy's is attractive. He's good looking. I like to see him jump off of things and stuff, and it isn't. I haven't got anything specific against him. I feel like, and here's my theory now, it's called the counter cruise. You ready for it? You're a man who's nearly, so nearly, more than me, abandoned expectation, perception, you know. You're a man unto your own. That's what I'm saying, right? But you've got a tiny, tiny little contrarian living inside of you. And his name is Tom Cruise. That's the counter Cruise theory right there. Everyone else laughs at Tom Cruise because he's a Scientologist and because he's obviously, you know, there's obviously something odd about him. And then you, the boy made out of film posters, you walk around and you go, no, it's the double bluff. It's the counter Cruise. Don't laugh at Cruise. He's actually a terrific actor. And if you knew about how he did this thing, you would understand. If you knew as much as me, you'd like him.
No, I would never have that conversation with anyone because I would look like an absolute fucking knob end.
But do you want to know what I really think? I need to believe that I'm watching a human being. And when I watch Tom Cruise, I'm watching Tom Cruise. And I'm watching the guy that I've seen on chat shows with that smile and with that intensity. And I just don't find him compelling or emotional. And so in this film, I said at the beginning, as a teenager, I watched Vanilla Sky and thought the scenes between him and Penelope Cruz were compelling and enjoyable and romantic and intoxicating. I watched them as an adult, and I think they have no chemistry, and I think Penelope Cruz is having to work very, very hard to make it seem like there's any kind of spark between them.
This is why I think me 2 years ago thought there was actually more to this film, because of the very thing you've just said. Because this is a rare Tom Cruise film that speaks particularly to who he is. This is all about the character is basically a stand-in for a Tom Cruise alike, and it's so much about his face.
Yeah,
and he is such a he's a phony, rich, weird guy, and I think there's something going on there. There is also it was the first time that I'd picked up on any Scientology vibes. There are minor to major Scientology vibes bubbling in this film. There's a bit where he's got a messed up face, and they're saying he's complaining about his headaches, and they say, you know, just take the medication, and he rattles his pills and he goes, ah, pills.
Yeah.
And Scientologists notoriously hate pills.
They hate pills. They love syringes, but they hate pills.
But there is so much about this film is about his face, the character's face, and Tom Cruise's face.
Yeah.
And it really, it feels, he's clearly aware of all of that, and he feeds it into, he's made a film for everyone to see and to kind of expose and bare himself to the world. Like, I know what's going on. I know what you all think of me. And I think this is as close to who he is. And it's all in the film. The text is his life. Mm. And I don't think he was particularly popular at this point. It feels quite, what's the word? It feels...
Apropos?
No, it feels quite, he's exposing himself.
Sure.
In this film. Not literally. And Cameron Crowe is that kind of filmmaker as well. His films are very heart on sleeve. Some of it just doesn't land because it clangs. The lines are cheesy.
I'll see you again in another life when we are both cats.
But do you not think that there's something in this film, like it manages to negotiate some really jarring tones from, particularly with the Cameron Diaz character. It's probably her best performance, I'd say.
I agree. She is terrific in the film.
She is mad and kooky, but then when she turns on him, it is positive. You absolutely buy it, and it is actually quite upsetting. And she, the lines of dialogue, they're very fruity. And it's a tough scene, and it's not laughable though.
No, I mean, I watched this with my wife, and
she says, "I've swallowed your cum."
Yeah, and that means something.
Yeah, like that line of dialogue in most films, most Hollywood films, I think would cause a big uproar of laughter. I don't think you'd even get that film in it. You would not get that line in a Hollywood film, and this is a Hollywood film. So I kind of, it's getting credit in the bank for me for stuff like that.
For sure. I agree. And listen, there are definitely good things about the film. Cameron Diaz and the character is one of those things. And Cameron Diaz is, I think her, I agree with you that it's her best performance. The character is so desperate, and Cameron Diaz plays that amazingly. And I watched this film with my wife, and one of the things that she said is, you know, we were remarking on how Cameron Diaz is an incredibly aesthetically attractive woman. And yet in those scenes, when she plays that desperation, when she plays that sadness, she's so unattractive as a character, right? Like, that's a really hard thing to do for someone super hot, right? That is a tell of a really, really good performance. And she clearly, like, you know, throws herself into it. I couldn't think of another film that she was as good in as this one.
It makes you think, what, you know, how wasted she's been. She doesn't act really anymore. And I think after There's Something About Mary, she kind of just got put in shit comedies.
She's terrific. And also, look, Penelope Cruz is really great in it as well. She has some hammy lines.
She's not.
I think she is. Some hammy lines, some cheesy lines. But I think she's having to work very hard to create that chemistry, which just isn't there.
There is something about when you talked about loving this film as a teen.
Yeah,
That's when you're going to love this film, if at all, because it speaks to the romance, and the final line is also about this, about, you know, this. That one perfect moment, that one perfect possibility where true love could exist.
Yeah.
When you're young, you want to eat that up with a spoon.
Yum, 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 yum.
You want to believe that you're going to meet Penelope Cruz at a party and she's going to talk to you.
I look at Tom Cruise and the way that he's befuzzled, bemused, Tom Cruised in a way that is not like any other human I've ever seen before. And I think, oh, that must just be because I haven't met Penelope Cruz at a party yet. And when that happens to me, I'm also going to make these faces that don't make any sense.
That is a problem. But again, I think that he's making that face. You remember we did the never to be released Lord of the Rings episode. I had a big problem when the Eagles arrive during one of the big fights, and Pippin goes, eagles.
The eagles are coming. The air. The eagles.
I ragged on that for 10 minutes and you had the most amazing comeback that people are never going to hear because you fucked up the recording. You said, Adam, that is not for... That's for... You said, we people, viewers, who get so much from... we get our emotions,
reactions
from the people we're watching, other people's.
Yeah,
and that's what we take our cues from. So we see Pippin going, eagles, oh! So we see his excitement, we see he's excited, and then we get excited.
Yeah. That's how human psychology works. Oh, I got you really good with that, didn't I? I forgot all about that. Shame I deleted the recording.
You absolutely slammed me. And I said, and I ate humble pie. I said, you've got me... Bang to rights with that, Joe. But
plum.
But let's not have, at least let's change the line. Let's not have him say eagles.
He should go, oh yeah.
So in the same way, this I'm shining the mirror back at you. Tom Cruise is not pulling that face for you. He's pulling that face for the viewer to go, this woman's amazing and I've fallen in love with her.
Yes. I understand. So it is for me. Listen, you're shining the mirror on me, fine. I'm going to shine a mirror on you, okay? Just a quick mirror, just a little mirror, but this mirror, guess what colour it is? The colour of plum, mate, that's the colour. Now, the mirror I'm going to shine at you is this. The things you've said about Tom Cruise and this film, okay, giving the benefit of the doubt to Tom Cruise's face is number one, and the film dealing his reactions, you know, and then the film dealing in themes about... the face and Tom Cruise and the similarities between the character and the actor and all of that stuff. That's all lovely and it is good. And I like it as film analysis, yeah? But if I said any of that stuff about a film that you didn't like, you would tell me I was being far too kind and I was adding something that just isn't there, okay? And that's my plum mirror
for you. But what I love about you, Joe, is you're not a horrible person like me and you'd never say that to me. You'd never say it.
No, that's why I just held the mirror up. I didn't say it. I just held up a mirror.
I think it's because I know you'd never say that to me. I haven't heard anything you just said.
Okay, no, that's good. And that's why I'm such a good person in your head.
Do you know what I really feel is the most interesting thing about this whole experience? At the end, his subconscious has turned against himself. That's what the whole back end of the film is about. He's been having a lucid dream. He died.
Yeah.
He was in a car crash. Yeah. His face was all fucked up.
He signed a contract to put his consciousness into the lucid dream and then he commits suicide.
Yeah, he tried to hook up with Cruise, but he was a wreck. He fucked it. So he's been at a certain point, the film has had him and us in a lucid dream.
Yeah.
His subconscious has turned against him. Mm-hmm. He's full of so much self-loathing that he's turning his dream into a nightmare.
Yes.
Which incidentally is the plot of a great Red Dwarf episode.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, Red Dwarf already did this.
Red Dwarf did it early, yeah.
Yeah, really, like back in the late 80s. It's in the TV series and it's also in the book Better Than Life.
Yeah.
I would thoroughly recommend anyone, if you can dig it out, it's very hard to find now, Better Than Life, It's the sequel to the first Red Dwarf novel, and it's fantastic. I loved them when I was a teenager. But Red Dwarf did all of this already.
Sure, sure, sure.
The subconscious turning against the mind and yes. in the dream.
Yes.
So at the end of this, Cruz is given, it's like, we're going to reset you. You're going to get back, you can have this dream again.
Yeah.
Without any of the problems. Or do you want to wake up?
Or
150 years in the future.
Yeah.
You're perfect at fixing the ends of films.
Mm-hmm.
Two-part question. Do you think this is what the film has been about, waking up from reality? B, do you think it's a good ending? C, it's a three-part question. Would you wake up 150 years into the future to live? Is that the film's premise at the very end seems to be, you've got to live in the real world, mate.
Yeah.
You've got to wake up. They say it a million times.
Yeah.
So A, B, and
Open
C.
Your eyes.
A, B, C. What I can't remember what A was, but what's A?
A was, has the film been about this? I don't think the film has been about waking up. No, I think it's a lovely feeling. I do like the notion of the ending of this film because it feels very akin to foundational, fundamental human experiences. Like you get sick. You feel ill, you have a fever, the fever burns off, you start to come through it, and then the light comes up in the morning and you look out the window and you think, God, it's good to be alive, you know, and you have that fantastic feeling of freedom and a rush of love and joy and excitement, and you think, I'm going to change everything, I'm going to be a different person, I'm going to remember this feeling and embrace life and not take things for granted. And then, 10 minutes later, you've forgotten all about it and you're pissed off, you're back at work and so I do like the ending for that reason. Now, to the final point, would I wake up 150 years in the future? Fuck yeah, I would. I'm up for that. I want to see what's going on. And also, by the sounds of it, I'll just go back to sleep again if I want to. I think that, whatever, who cares? What about you?
Well, I think the choices are nonsense. I don't think right. the film has been about that. The film has repeatedly say, open up, wake up, man.
Yeah.
And I think that more speaks to, I get that it speaks to him as a character, but come the end, it's saying the only thing that matters is real life.
Right.
As opposed to this lucid dream, which is all BS because it right. all goes haywire.
Sure. I think it's saying real life, but it's also opening yourself up to experiences that you aren't controlling, right? Like being vulnerable with the world. That's what it's about.
But he's learned that lesson in the lucid dream. So the message doesn't make sense. There is no difference between a lucid dream and reality anyway.
Yes, there is.
No, there is not. It doesn't.
Reality, do you?
Yeah, but he doesn't even realise he's controlling the lucid dream. And also, I do control reality. I control my reality. It doesn't make a difference if he stays in the dream or wakes up in 150 years.
This is you as the philosophy professor.
Yeah, this is Matrix 101. Blue pill, red pill, who gives a fuck pill? None of it matters. It's all just experience, and it positions it as like, oh, I'm going to dare to live. I'm going to live in the real world. That's what matters. I'm going to be hurt, and I'm going to...
I dreamed a dream of times gone by.
It's this perfectly phony Hollywood ending
yeah.
that doesn't really mean anything.
It's cheating, but it works.
It absolutely, of course it does. It's a shoddy full stop, and I imagine is the ending of the original, and it's
sure.
it's just it's all just a bit basic, and I mean it doesn't matter because the film doesn't want to end. It wants to leave you feeling like your life matters. Oh,
yeah.
I my life matters, my reality matters. Tom Cruise chose my life. Like, no, he didn't. Your life is nothing, you loser. Fucker, you need this film to cheer yourself up. You need Tom Cruise to choose your real life to feel better about yourself.
You wish Tom Cruise chose your life.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
a dit...
What game have you got, Joe?
Well, you've got a choice of three games today. Game number one is Radiohead cheating? Game number two is eponymous songs, which is less of a game and more of a chat. And game number three is the box office game. What do you want to start with?
Well, we have to do the box office game.
Well, let's do the box office game as a starting point then, okay? Now, box office budget, brackets estimated, for Vanilla Sky. Now, it's got Timothy Cruise in, doesn't it? So, and they managed to film in Times Square without anyone being in there. So I bet that cost some money. What do you reckon?
It's a Tom Cruise film. It's costing a pretty penny, but it's not. There's no explosions.
Well, there's quite a lot of CG though towards the end.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Oh,
I'm talking about
real life explosions
for the audience, for the trailer. What's the trailer? The marketing department need to go. What is the trailer?
Right.
Oh, there's no explosions. Why not? Is there anyone running? Oh, there is. Okay, nice. Okay, add on 10 mil. So I would say it cost $80 million.
Oh, not far off. Pretty close. $68 million.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good guess. It is, of course, outside the 10%, but it is a fairly good guess.
I should have said, okay, I know what you should have said. I should have said 68.
You should have said 68. You didn't say that. Yeah. You didn't say that. That's fine. Not to worry, yeah? Now, is this film going to make some money? I think you will know. Opening weekend, US and Canada, but get this, 2001, December 16.
I don't care who you are. This is difficult because it's Cruise. But as I say, he's not running anywhere.
Well, he is doing a little bit of running. He is doing some running. He runs away at the end all the way up to the top, remember? I bet they use that in the trailer.
Yeah, they'll do an adjustment bureau on the trailer.
I bet they will. I bet they'll have him jumping off the building in the trailer.
This is going to be so... This'll speak to Cruise's ability to open a film. Because if this opens, it's all down to Cruise.
Well, for a $68 million budget, what would you be calling an open? When does it become an open?
I mean, in what, 2001?
Yep.
In the 20s.
Okay.
20s an open. Is it doing that? Is it open? Is it going to get 20? I know you don't. Oh yeah, come and listen to Radiohead and REM on the soundtrack. I think it made $15 million.
Oh no 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 no! It made more.
Did it?
Made $25 million.
Oh, that's good, man. He's
the boy can open.
That's Buffo. For this is a nothing film, and people are turning up.
People are turning
up. A Cruise alone. That is what I'm talking about.
Yes.
When I talk about opening a film.
Well, that's what happened. It done opened at $25 million the weekend before Christmas, 2001. Now, does it cruise on to a big gross worldwide? What do you think?
I think it does. Mm-hmm. It was not a stinker. It may have divided audiences. They may not have liked it. But it's still romantic. It's broadly entertaining. The whole middle bit is, you know, massively overlong.
Yeah, I mean, something we didn't mention is that the whole second half of the film is far worse than the first half. But, you know, go on. Gross worldwide.
$160 million?
Well, you underestimate our Lord Cruise once again. This film, 225, my friend. Oof. $225 million.
The power of cruise controls. That's a hell of a return.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good for Vanilla Sky.
For that, I mean, for that kind of caper.
Yeah, not bad at all.
That's a hit, man. That's a hit.
216, incredible. Well done to everyone involved.
The film ends. Now you've begun the film with one of the great Radiohead songs.
So
evocative. It establishes tone. You don't have to do any work. Tone is established. Tom York et al. Have done the work. The film ends. And
look up at that vanilla sky. Have you ever seen anything like it? Doop doop a doop a doop doop a doop.
Paul McCartney.
Ringo, play them drums a little harder, my boy. We've got to get down the cavern.
Paul McCartney starts singing a song. And it sounds like Paul McCartney, and you think, oh, I've not heard this Paul McCartney song before.
No.
And then he in the lyrics are lines from the film. My ears perked up at that. I thought, oh, has Cameron Crowe heard this kind of obscure Paul McCartney song and then called the film Vanilla Sky? And no, lo and behold, he asked Paul McCartney to write a song specifically for Vanilla Sky. Hello, who's that?
Hey, is that Paul McCartney?
Oh, yeah, how do? Who's calling?
Hi, Paul. It's Cameron Crowe here calling. Listen, I'm making this movie with Tom Cruise, Penelope Cruz, and Cameron Diaz. It's called Vanilla Sky, and it's based on Los Abuelos, the Spanish movie. You probably won't have seen it, but it's beat for beat. Anyway, listen, we think it's going to be a killer in the year of 2001, and Paul, I was having this dream last night. I thought the film ends, and at the moment, it's just a quiet end. There's no music or anything. And I think I need to resolve that. Now, I could just put another Radiohead song over the end, and that would be pretty good. But then I thought, what's the best music guy I could get? I'm a guy who... this is something you'll learn about me, Paul. I shoot for the stars, okay? And now I'm calling you Paul McCartney of the Beatles. Would you write an eponymous title song, Vanilla Sky? Would you do it for me? For $1 million.
Oh, Vanilla Sky. Oh, that's a nice title. I'm already starting to think of rhymes. What rhymes with sky? Fly. Oh, you know, it starts to kick off, and you know what? I don't think this will be something too difficult for me. I'll just start noodling. I'll probably have a dream, you know, have a cup of tea, and then a lovely little tune will come out, and I'll record it with my friends, and they'll send it over. Will you put it in your movie, even if it's rubbish?
Listen, I can guarantee you're Paul McCartney, even if it is fucking dog shit. I'll put it in the film. And guess what? You're Paul. I'm Cameron Crowe. We've got Tom Cruise, Penelope Cruz, and Cameron Diaz in the movie. It's 2001. If you do this, it's going to get nominated for an Oscar.
Some of what I just said were things that Paul McCartney was reported as saying when he was asked to write the song for Vanilla Sky. Yeah, it's a bad song.
It's not a bad song. It's just it's just in the context, it's a weird song. Out of the context, it's just a fine, like, normal, nice Paul McCartney song.
Given this, the rest of the film has been this carefully curated mixtape.
But guess what you can't do, Adam? You can't call Paul McCartney. Do you know what you can't do? You can't call Paul McCartney and ask him to write a song for your film and then not use the song. That you can't do that in a way that you could with almost any other artist in the world. But there's a list of people that you can't do it with, and Paul McCartney is one of them.
There is a line in the film where Kurt Russell says to him, oh, you know, it's all about growing up. It really spoke to me, this bit. Kurt Russell's a father. The figment of Kurt Russell's a father. And he says, oh, you know, you start off being a John Lennon fan and then you grow up and you turn into, you realise you're into Paul. Mm-hmm. And then Tom Cruise goes, I always liked George.
Yeah, of course you did, because you're a vacant nothing.
I don't like any of them because I don't care about the Beatles.
But obviously Paul's the best one. We all understand that.
I don't know, whatever. But it's one of those conversations that music people have. And then, so the character, the film is telling you, grow up, get into Paul.
Yeah.
And then the film ends with Paul.
Yeah.
It's like, how about fuck off? How about, I don't know, just stop having such bland, shit, obvious taste in music?
Sure, sure.
Should we do the bit of the podcast where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot to try and catch out the other one?
I'd bloody love to do that.
They forgot.
I'd bloody love to do that. I think it's my turn to read the list to you.
It is.
Oh my God, I'm excited. Okay, you ready for me?
I am ready.
Here we go, 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 here we go. Night at the Museum.
Oh, I don't like how little you think of me.
You've got kids, so maybe, you know, they're around. I don't know if they've seen that or...
No. Never seen it. Never would.
Okay. Boyhood.
No, because I hated it so much.
Fair enough. Okay.
And you've tried that before. I don't like you trying Boyhood on me. And when I say hate, like, when I use hate very specifically, I love Richard Linklater. I found it very boring and baffled at why anyone was talking about it. And a great achievement, but of no interest. Shit film. A shit film.
Shit film. Okay. Great Gatsby.
No, that's Baz Luhrmann. I'm not watching that.
No? Okay, fine.
I'm not watching Baz Luhrmann take one of the great novels and smear all his neon shit on it, thanks. No.
Okay, sure. I'm just looking for ones I actually want to watch and not ones that I'm running out. La La Land.
Oh, come on, mate. I'd love an excuse to rewatch that, but that is not a movie. Anyone forgot.
Sure. Okay, fine. I thought it was a sneaky. I thought I'd be able to sneak in there, maybe a little sneaky. Okay. How about Inherent Vice?
You tried to do me on that before. I'm not having it. I'm not watching that film again.
I've deleted it. Okay. The Revenant.
Fuck. Oh, fuck.
I genuinely watched that one time.
Yeah, I said...
with some flatmates in Greenwich and, I don't know, it was forever. But...
No, I mean...
I maybe haven't forgotten it, but I've forgotten almost everything that happens in the film apart from... The bear. Like, I'd no memory of what happens in that film. Yeah.
And that's why I'm going to let you... I've had zero interest. Sub-zero. Yes. You know, like, I literally, like, you know, seriously never, ever had any interest in putting that film on.
Sure.
So it's not so much a movie I forgot. It's a movie I deliberately placed in the cupboard... the back of the cupboard and said, "Well, I don't need anything to do with you."
It's coming out of the cupboard now though, Richmond, isn't it? And you're going to unpack it into the saucepan like a little bit of old hard pasta and you're going to think, surely this can't still be okay to eat, but it is okay to eat and we're going to have to eat it.
We're doing DiCaprio again.
DiCaprio appears in a lot of forgettable films. I tried to get you, DiCaprio's in Gatsby as well.
This is his hat trick. Revolutionary Road, yeah. The Beach, and The Revenant.
Yeah. I mean, we're well into the 30s, so I think we're continuing on the theme of getting one DiCaprio every 10 episodes.
I got given The Revenant as a Christmas present about 4 years ago.
Really? Yeah. What, on Blu-ray or something?
No, the book.
Oh, right.
I'm now scanning my bookshelves. It is on my bookshelf.
Desperately worried that he's going to have to read it between now and next week.
Did I give it away to the charity shop? Oh, I hope not, because I do want to read it. I do want to read it now. Just for the podcast, not for my own edification.
Well, there we go. It's The Revenant.
Okay, well, that was the Vanilla Sky episode. You have been listening to the Movies You Forgot podcast. Send us an email, moviesyouforgotyouforgot@gmail.com. Tell us directors as cheeses. That's kind of, that's an old school reference. If you get it, you get it. Tell us your heist teams. We still want to hear about your heist teams. Try and catch us out with a movie you think we would have forgot we forgot. We will add it onto the list if it counts.
Yep.
Do follow me on Letterboxd. At Error of Ways as well. I will follow you back straight away. And that's it. Anything else, Joe?
No, that's it. I look forward to watching The Revenant. Oh, except actually one thing. Please tell a friend about this podcast if you like it. And if you're still listening this far deep into the end, then just force one other person in your life to listen to it, and that would be very kind.
That's how you spread the word, isn't it? That's how people get onto podcasts.
I'm only interested in word that comes from mouth.
Word from mouth.
Yeah. I'm only interested in word from mouth. Word from mouth is a good...
I think we're going to get nil by mouth.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.